First of all, could you provide me with some background information on the architects of Guilt, like the writing process for the record and gathering the songs and everything?
Yeah, it was this record was about 2 years in the making, and being the first album, and this one our singer left the band, so I switched instruments. I used to play bass. I'm the vocalist now. We brought in a new bass player and started writing the record, and about a month after that happened, our recording studio burnt down with all of our equipment in it, and so then we had to scramble to find all new equipment, and we pretty much wrote an entirely new album after that. Before we went in, you know, kind of had to regroup a little bit. So yeah, we definitely, you know, went through some trials and tribulations and trouble coming out with this record, but I think a little bit of the background on it is kind of just explains why it is kind of the angry, pretty aggressive record that we ended up with.
Is it a better record than the one that sadly got lost?
Oh yeah, absolutely, without a doubt. That's why, you know, a lot of questions have been like, well, how much material and things like that did you lose? And you know, my response to that is I'm not exactly sure. I don't really remember. You know, we had some songs that were pretty much completely done. We had songs that were outlined, and one or two of those ended up making it onto the record. The stuff that didn't make it because we took time and wrote, you know, we were better material. Like, I don't think there are a lot of bands that would go back. The Dillinger Escape Plan, for instance, wouldn't want to go back and just write a record now in 2011 that was a whole bunch of stuff like 43% burnt or under the rotting board, because they've progressed, and you know, I think that they're a good example of a band that's really come into their own sound. And I think for us it was the same thing. We had a little bit more time put into it, and a little bit more aggression and anger to, I guess, kind of work out in the songs, so we definitely ended up with a stronger record as a result of this whole thing. So, you know, in a way I go, well, you know, obviously our studio burning down was a horrible thing and it set us all back financially, but I think the record benefited from it, you know.
Was it liberating in a weird way to restart with a clean slate, so to speak?
Yeah, I mean, it was almost like we got a second chance on this album, kind of, you know? And we were kind of coming into it with a fresh bass anyway, just because of, you know, half the band that recorded on the last record is different for this album. So we knew that we were definitely going to kind of break out in a different way, and we had different musicians and different inputs and things like that, so, you know, the writing process was really neat and a lot different than it was for the last record, and then everybody wrote for this album, and I had the opportunity to write all the lyrics for this record, whereas, you know, the lyrics on the last album were kind of a scattershot, where everybody kind of had their hands in the pot, so that gave me the opportunity to form a little bit more of a pointed narrative with the record. So we had a lot of opportunities going into it this time that we didn't have before.
What were the reasons behind Chris's departure?
I mean, really what it comes down to is Chris was in New York City and the rest of us were here in North Texas. And, you know, we're not a band. We all have, you know, our wives and our jobs and kids and things like that. So being on the road 9 months out of the year isn't really a viable option for us at this point. Just money isn't there. So our best option to kind of help our band, you know, reach people is to play regionally and, you know, do as many local shows as we can and really try to branch out into the areas surrounding Texas. And that was pretty much impossible with Chris in New York City. So with things the way they were with him up there, we kind of just had to, more or less, if we weren't on tour, we were just sitting stagnant. You know, and then there's the kind of added technical difficulties of he couldn't even hear the songs, put lyrics to them until we had recorded demos of them to ship them up there. It's just, you know, when you're 14 and you start a band, that's not necessarily how you envision it being, but we kind of had to make the tough decision form, definitely, if that hadn't happened. And we all hope now that we'll be able to take some of the steps that we couldn't take before. I don't want to feel like Chris was holding us back. I think it really put the pressure, applied the pressure to him. He probably would have moved him and his wife down here, but for the career that he's in, you know, which is graphic design and things like that, New York is really the place where he needs to be. So, you know, I can speak for all of us. You know, we didn't want to apply that kind of pressure for him to uproot his entire family and come down here, you know, to chase a rock and roll dream kind of thing, because there's no guarantee that something like that is going to play out. Then where does that leave us? You know, he's left, you know, everything that he had built up behind, not going to be able to really pursue his career down here. So, you know, it was, it wasn't a pleasant time, and it wasn't a happy decision to be made, but it was something that needed to happen. And I think, I really feel like it was something that was going to happen sooner or later. So
you pushed him before he jumped then, more or less?
Well, and I know, like, the whole conversation kind of came as a surprise to him. But I think that, yeah, you're probably right, and that eventually that's how it would have come down. So, you know, if you just look at it on paper, we couldn't continue to operate the way that we were, you know, and it's not fair to expect him to float, you know, $600 or $700 in airfare round trip just for us to play one or two local shows, or for him to come down here and put his vocals to demo tracks and things like that. I mean, it's just, we don't have the money to bankroll those kinds of efforts, and it's not fair to expect him to shoulder that burden. Something had to give.
Yeah, and it would have led to bad feeling anyway, with, like, not being able to do the local shows.
What's that now?
I said it would have, with the band not being able to do so many local shows, that would have led to bad feeling anyway, probably.
Yeah, and definitely, it's like, you know, I could see that path leading to resentment. You know, fortunately, it never reached that point, and I have nothing but love for Chris, but, you know, I could see being like, you know, because I had a career that I put on hold, and I could see a couple years down the road going, hey, if we just had a singer who was here, I could feel like we could make a really honest run of this thing. You know, and it would be a shame, and it would be unfair to Chris for him to be the face of anybody's resentment just because of location. And yeah, you know, I mean, there's still people who, you know, who I see at all the heavy metal shows down here who had no idea that the Famine was even from Dallas. And that's really a shame, you know, because I think that there's a good portion of what we do that is very, like, Texas based, kind of, you know, in the lyrics and even a little bit in our music. So for the people with whom we're supposed to be identifying the most, for them to not even know that we're around or that we're from here, you know, it hurts.
Yeah, definitely. How did the, like, obviously Chris left, but anyway, how did that lead to you from going from bass to vocals then?
I had been a vocalist in a few bands before joining the Famine. Actually, the Famine was the first time I ever really played bass. I was always a guitar player or a singer before coming into the Famine. And when I started talking to the Famine guys, it was to come in and play rhythm guitar. But, you know, they needed to fill the bass spot before they could get a rhythm guitar player. So, you know, and I was just happy to be a part of it in any capacity where I could. So I hopped in on bass and was happy to do it. And, you know, playing bass is something that I grew to really enjoy. But they knew that I had a background as a vocalist before this, and then I was also doing all the background vocals in the live setting. And everybody who's seen us live, you know, there's a good portion of background vocals in the live show, especially for the older material. So they had heard me, you know, night in and night out. They knew what I could do vocally. And I guess when the decision came down, like, well, Chris is gone, you know, and I was happy to play bass and have my friend and Chris in the band. So, you know, it wasn't a situation where I was vying for Chris's spot. But I think the decision came down for those guys that, you know, the new singer was going to be the face of the band, and they really would rather be somebody that they knew and could trust than bringing in somebody from the outside and really just taking another chance. You know, because the singer handles so much PR and publicity and things like that. I think for them, they knew my vocals, they knew what I could do, and they also knew me as an individual, so they felt comfortable with kind of putting me out there, and they knew that I could stand up to a lot of the, you know, criticism and things like that for not being Chris, being somebody who knew and knows Chris and has a lot of love for him, you know. I think I was in the right position to kind of delicately handle that situation. So really what happened was I went on vacation, and I was out of the country, and then I came back home, and my inbox was full of emails, and they had decided and announced that I was a singer while I was out of the country, and I had no idea.
So, what is your passion then? Is your main passion for singing, for playing bass, or for playing guitar?
You know, it's hard to say at this point because, you know, there's also a band where I play drums, and there's a band where I sing and play guitar.
Jack of all trades.
Master of none. I mean, I was playing bass in the Salmon. I was singing and playing guitar for, like, a rock and roll band, and then I was playing drums for a band all at the same time. Guitar is really where all the doors opened up for me as a guitar player, and that's what really helped me get a neck up playing music professionally. But I always considered myself a guitar player, but I love doing all those things. You know, I'm a really big Megadeth fan, and Dave Mustaine, one of the earlier Megadeth records, he wrote that entire album on a bass guitar. So it's really easy, you know, halfway bass and say, hey, bass is for people who aren't good at guitar. But having played it now, I understand how it's crucial that your theory and that your technique be spot on and things like that. So, I mean, to answer your question, I love all of them. I view myself as a guitar player. But, you know, in this capacity now, I'm a vocalist and I'm happy to do it and I love it. So really, I'm just a fan of music and I'm happy to hop in and do whatever I can do to help, you know, facilitate a vision.
Is this going to be a permanent position for you in terms of the vocals or is it just for now?
Yeah. No, this is going to be it. And I think especially after the recording of this record, with writing all the lyrics and things like that, I think that a precedent was set. And, you know, I think we all kind of stopped looking for somebody after I stepped in. And, you know, they saw how I handled myself on stage and doing interviews and things like that. I'm comfortable doing it. It's something that I really like. I really enjoy serving the band in this capacity. And, you know, we have a fantastic bass player. Our bass player now, John, is a much better bass player than I was. So, I think all the pieces really fit right now, which is good.
Yeah. Did the band find out afterwards, what caused the recording studio to catch fire?
I'm sorry?
Did the band find out what caused the recording studio to catch fire or not?
Yeah, actually we had, one of our pre-production engineers was in the studio working on doing some mixes for some of our material when it happened, and there was a studio, so the entire thing was insulated with soundproofing, and I guess a breaker switch blew, and when it did, it sent out, you know, a tiny arc of electricity, which was just enough to touch the sound insulation.
Okay.
And that stuff's essentially, you know, glorified styrofoam, and when you light styrofoam on fire, it just turns into napalm, more or less, and this stuff was all over the walls and all over the ceiling. So, the pre-production engineer said by the time that he turned around and saw what was going on, literally the ceiling was melting and falling down onto him. You know, and it burned through his clothes and things like that. He was lucky to make it out alive, really. And we found out later on, because Mark and Andy, our drummer and guitar player, are actually both contractors. They kind of went in after the place was all burnt out. out and got it, and, you know, the fires had been put out. They went in to do a little forensic investigation, and I think they found out that the electrician may have cut some corners. There's way too much power going through the wires into that breaker, which is what caused that breaker to blow, and then it sparked out onto the soundproofing. So, you know, it was kind of just a freak accident, really. You know, it's not like somebody was being careless or anything like that, as far as I could tell. It started out as an electrical fire, but because of the soundproofing, it was just... and the soundproofing melting on our gear and the smoke caused a lot more damage than the actual flames did.
Okay, was there any water damage?
I'm sorry?
Oh, I'm sorry, you were saying about the...
No, it's just once that black smoke gets onto and into electronics and things like that, it pretty much fouls everything up, or it's not salvageable.
Oh, I was going to ask if there was any water damage at all from,
Yeah, there was, because when the fire, it was like a 5-alarm fire. And when the fire department showed up, they didn't know that it was a recording studio. So they kicked the door in. I think there was a big metal bay door that they had to cut through with a kind of Jaws of Life type apparatus. And they went in, hoses blazing, and I mean just doused everything. And they were stepping on, you know, $3,000 guitar amps and things like that, just because they didn't know. I guess the guy who was heading up the operation, after they figured out, hey, this is a recording studio, I told his guys to take it easy and apologize to us, but I mean, you know, he was just doing his job. They were just doing their job. So I'd rather have some of our equipment be water damaged than have the fire spread out to the entire building and catch the greater part of the city on fire.
Yeah.
Have it turn into a Chicago Mrs. O'Leary's cow kind of thing where, you know, we're responsible for burning down the greater portion of North Texas.
So what did the band lose in that fire then? And how did it, money-wise, how did they go about getting equipment to re-record and whatever?
Well, our drummer, I think that he was able to refurbish and salvage the shells to his drums, which in itself cost him money, and he pretty much lost everything else. You know, in regards to hardware and cymbals and things like that. Our guitar player's guitar amp was melted. I mean, completely melted. And, he lost one guitar completely. And then there was another guitar that was very badly damaged that he had to put in the shop for 4 months to repair. And same situation with the bass. Speaker cabs were all really damaged, but we were able to have most of them repaired. Biggest loss really was because the fire started in the control room. So anything that was in the control room, which was, you know, the guitars and the bass and the amp heads and their actual recording equipment, was all just completely gone. Because, you know, once you spray a water hose on a $10,000 preamp, a paperweight. And a lot of it, our drummer owned, and I mean, that was all, none of it was salvageable at all, and that was just a complete loss. So, and some of it our pre-production engineers owned, you know, things like microphones and things like that. So almost 100% of the actual recording equipment was useless, was trash. I'd say about half of our actual musical gear was either completely destroyed or very badly damaged and in need of repair. So what we did, kind of like I was saying earlier, you know, I play guitar in this band and bass in another band and drums in another band. So I actually have a different practice space where I rehearse with other bands that's full of my gear. Now, and I have guitar amps and bass amps and drums and all those kinds of things. So pretty much a couple weeks later, we just moved into that space and wrote the rest of the record on what borrowed equipment we could piece together, and we kind of recorded the album with that same stuff.
Okay, what was it like re-recording the record then? In August, I believe it was re-recorded.
Yeah. It was actually a pretty neat experience, because we were answering to somebody. We were working with Braxton Henry, who was engineering the album, whereas before, when we were recording it in our studio, go, hey, that vocal take, you know, is a little pitchy, let's try it low, and things like that. So, we were, you know, I think we were aware of the situation going into it, of, hey, this album should have been done 6 months ago.
How quick was the material written then?
Really? I'm gonna say probably 6 or 7 of the songs were written in the period between our studio burning down and us going in to record the new material.
And how long would that be?
That was, I think the studio burned down in February, so it was April, May, June, July, 6 months.
Okay.
I mean, there were some practices, you know, we would practice twice a week, and we'd be writing, you know, writing and finishing a song or two every month, and then going back through and discarding ideas and things like that. So we really, once the studio burned down, we realized, you know what, we have this opportunity now. The earliest we could get in the studio was August, and we didn't want to go in with the same batch of songs if we had motivation and the ability and the opportunity to go in and try to write something new, so we really hit the ground running.
Okay, how would you compare this record to The Raven and The Reaping?
I think it's a much heavier record. I think that the last record was definitely, you know, a heavy metal album, but a lot of times it fell into kind of a mid-paced, which I think, you know, the biggest criticism you could say is it got a little bit monotonous after a while. And it felt a little bit mechanical with all the drums being sound replaced, and it was a little too perfect. But for this record, we incorporated some tempo feels it never used before. You know, the last track on this album, it has a very slow, kind of like Death March, obituary kind of feel. And a lot of the first tracks that we've been releasing have a much more kind of thrashy, like Anthrax, suicidal tendencies. You know, 80s crossover hardcore kind of feel, but still all filtered through the death metal scope. And then, you know, there are a lot more blast beats on this record. I think it's much more of a death metal album than the last record was. But, I mean, to me, it sounds like just everything that was going on in extreme metal in 1995, if you just mix it all up. Whereas I think the last record was more of a groove metal, definitely. You know, I could see how people would think that it's maybe a little bit of Pantera derivative or something like that, and I think a lot of those vestiges are gone with this album, and this album is a little bit more of just a full bore heavy death metal record.
Okay, so the band's really into those early death metal bands that like sort of brought the genre about then.
Yeah, I mean, for me, the big band was Carcass. I'm a huge Carcass fan. I think, you know, with my vocal styles, that kind of comes across for our bass player. His big band that he was into was Death. And then Mark and Andy were really big into Suffocation. I mean, Cannibal, you know, we were all into bands like Cannibal Corpse and Deicide and things like that, but, you know, if you take a little bit of, you know, what Carcass was doing and a little bit of what Death was doing on the technical end and a little bit of the Suffocation brutality, and then you kind of add in some of the, you know, elements of suicidal tendencies and ERI and kind of thrashier and a little bit of, like, grind influence, and that's pretty much where it ends up. But there are definitely those landmark bands in death metal for all of us, you know, and I mean, there really hasn't been a band since, you know, 1995 that gets me excited like Carcass did.
Yeah. When you say grind, do you mean like Napalm Death or something? Or?
Yeah, a big Napalm Death fan. and then a lot of the early crossover stuff, like even the noisier kind of side of it, like AC and bands like that. I like bands like Pig Destroyer and Agoraphobia, you know, those bands who kind of were second tier bands, but Repulsion and things like that. But yeah, definitely Napalm Death was a fountainhead of all that kind of stuff. Because for me, you know, writing the lyrics, John and I both were into punk rock before we were into metal. And crossover and then grind were kind of what got me into death metal. Because to me, grind was like the punk rock of death metal. You know, they were still writing political lyrics, and Napalm Death is still carrying that torch today. Really short, fast song structures, which is what I was used to, and that's kind of what I do. So it helped me going, hey, okay, I can identify with these guys' politics, and that gives me an inroad to understanding the aggression and all that kind of stuff. It was a little bit easier, a little bit more accessible for me than, you know, just hopping from, you know, from Black Flag right into Strip Reef and Strangled by a Cable Corpse, you know. I don't really identify with being a priest or Strangled.
Yeah, definitely. Tell me about some of these topics on the record, because they seem pretty philosophical to me.
Yeah, you know, I don't think that I'm talented enough yet to write a concept album. It's something that I'd like to do at some point, but this record definitely has a theme to it. It's kind of just like, I guess you can see the various collapses in society, and I view it through a few different filters. I mean, to me, there are a few songs on there that deal pretty openly and frankly with the racism that still exists, particularly in the American South. You know, the subtext of that kind of expanding out into the realms of, you know, sexism and homophobia and anti-Semitism, but really like the white supremacy movement and how things like that are going on under all of our noses and kind of choose not to believe, you know, what's going on in the neighbor's house and things like that.
You're referring to the new hell or not, though?
Yeah, the new hell is one of the songs that kind of, you know, we say hanging by our necks from the Bible Belt is one of the songs in there, is one of the lyrics, and there's this weird, you know, I talk about, mention James Byrd in that song by name, and he was a black man who was dragged to death behind a truck in Jasper, Texas in 1998. His body broke apart into 75 pieces across 3 miles of country road. This is something that happened 13 years ago in my home state. And it's not discussed. It's not talked about. It's not taught in schools. It's not brought up in polite conversation. It's not something that a lot of people know about.
I think
New Hell is pretty much saying, why not? This is reality. Our hands did that. You know? That's our society. That's something that happens. Things like that are not isolated incidences.
Yeah, you made a good point, actually, in talking about that song. You mentioned about one guy getting killed and something about him converting to Christianity and then being more lenient on him or something, like a murderer.
And there was kind of the same thing again going on in Texas. There was a young guy, his name was Brian Beneke, and he was a 19-year-old punk rocker in this kind of cow town called Amarillo, which is, you know, West Texas, kind of middle of nowhere. And it was the typical, you know, almost like Jets versus Sharks kind of thing, where all the football players hated all the punk rockers. And there was this guy, he was a football player, you know, they called him a jock or whatever. Anyway, he ran over Brian Denneke guy, a punk rocker, outside of the Denny's, and he killed him. And he bragged about it. And then the case went to court, and the guy got off with no jail time because his lawyers were able to show, listen, he's a church-going Christian, and this guy was a punk rock scumbag. The subtext of that being like, you know, my client's life is worth something, and this guy was a godless heathen, you know, who listened to music that was destroying his family and things like that, which wasn't the case at all. By all accounts, Brian Denneke was a lovable human being who was, you know, contributing to society in every way that he could. And his life was cut short by somebody who was pardoned for it, because that's the nature of our society. I think it's disgusting, and I wish more people would talk about things like that.
Yeah, definitely, because I find that, because if I'm right, you're a Christian gentleman. Would I be right, or would I be wrong, or? Are you Christian or not? Or am I wrong? I don't know, you know.
It's okay, and a lot of people, you know, this is something that's been preached in conversation, and I guess the line, it makes me uncomfortable speaking about, you know, my faith or my religion or my lack of either of those things in the public forum, because I feel like people are just going to interpret the song lyrics through that.
But are you a Christian
absolutely. You know, I attend church every Sunday. The people are going to go, oh, well, he's chastising.
No, bro, I mean, is you Christian, though, or not, though?
Well, I get... That's not how I would describe me.
Okay, because I just found it very interesting that you sort of write in a song like that about how Christianity was being exploited. That's all. I found that pretty interesting. It's not something a lot of people explore. That's at least my sort of find.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think that there's a very biblical interpretation of that same message. And if you look at it through that light, it makes me even more uncomfortable, you know, to know that a lot of these things are being pardoned in the name of the church and something like that. If that was something that I felt was representing me and my beliefs and my values, I'd be disgusted by it, even more so.
Yeah, what are the sort of lyrics on the record? Because I believe you talk about stuff like addiction and some of the stuff as well.
Yeah, addiction and suicide and, you know, all the hits. But for me, addiction isn't just, you know, if you're using a needle or if you're pouring yourself into a bottle every night. Addiction could be, you know, something like gambling, or addiction could be religion. And that's something that people don't want to talk about either. The fact that, you know, if you're a mess of a human being because you're pouring yourself into a bottle of whiskey every night, and then one day you have a miraculous conversion to the Baptist faith, but you're still a mess, and you're out on a street corner screaming Bible verses at me now instead of freaking yourself to sleep every night. You still have a problem, and you're still an addict. Now you're addicted to Jesus instead of, you know, alcohol or heroin or, you know, PCP or whatever it is. So, you know, when I say addiction, I'm not just talking about, you know, heroin. It's much addiction to me is anything that you use that stands between you and being the person that you need to be.
Yeah. And what about this track as well, A Fragile Piece, which is about people who are building glass walls around themselves, I think?
Yeah, and it's about, you know, we built a society that's here, you know, to be our safety net and things like that, and what happens when it doesn't work? There was a case here in the States, I believe. I want to say it happened in either Georgia, Alabama, or Tennessee. But anyway, one of the more southern states where a man's house caught on fire. His name was Eugene Kranich. His house caught on fire. And in his municipality, you had to pay, you know, I think it was something to the tune of $100 a year to the fire department for their services. And he had intended to pay his fee, but it had slipped his mind in the deadline and passed. And his house caught on fire. And the fire department showed up, watched his house burn down to the ground. While he stood there with his checkbook saying, I'll pay you any amount. I will pay you anything. Please put this fire out. He was a grandfather. You know, that died and burnt up in the house, and he lost everything. I mean, everything.
Christ.
Yeah.
You write about some scary stuff, a lot scarier than some stuff other people write about killing people, and that seems very, well, more scary to me anyway.
That's exactly right, because you think, hey, you know, I live in the United States. I live in one of the most developed nations in the entire world. We're the world's foremost power. And yet, you know, a society so developed and with such, you know, such strong morals, there was the, you know, the real moral majority crusade of the religious right taking place here in the 90s and all these things. You know, the Christian man who by all accounts pays his bills and, you know, this one slipped his mind. He can literally watch his life burn up in front of his eyes and have it be, you know, essentially